Chapter 7 171 High night came, bitter and clear, when the stars were full bright. Nairo and the other slaves dismounted from the temple rig in preparation for the observations, bringing mats and telescopes for the master. It was cold beneath the cloudless skies, and the slaves pulled tight such rags and cloaks as they had while they waited. Nairo looked up at the constellations. He knew a few, the mages, like any child of Colchis. The opening eye, with the red star of Valak as its pupil. The rising stair, which looked more like a waterfall to Nairo, but who was he to doubt the judgment of the ancients? The serrated sun, just above the horizon, called by some the Iron Halo of Cain. Almost directly overhead shone the exalted gates, through which could be seen the smudge that scholars testified to be the clouds surrounding the mountain of the Empyrean, the god peak to which the prophets had conducted the pilgrimage, whose precipitous and unwelcoming flanks they had ascended into the mists of the powers. Nairo had once stolen a look through his master's viewing scope when Cor Pharaon had been studying the exalted gates. He had seen the distant swirl that concealed the god peak, and for a moment had felt a connection to the powers. He had known in that moment what Cor Pharaon meant when he said that they dwelt beneath their immortal gaze. But it was impossible to reconcile that moment with the nature of his existence, nor accept on faith alone that his slavery, that the subjugation of millions, was an intended part of the powers' design.
Master!
His voice was a sharp whisper, his eyes constantly roving back to the rig and the guards upon the masts and at the rail. Not that they were bothered about the slaves trying to escape. Any fool who wanted to dare the wilderness alone would shortly be joining the powers. The deadly desert was more surety against escape than any patrols or fences. Nairo looked for a sign of their master appearing, for he desired no one to overhear his conversation, and was reminded of Lorgar's claims of extraordinary hearing. Maska approached at his furtive but insistent gesturing. Laura, Baphai, and Kaldeka responded to similarly clandestine summoning, congregating beside the main observational array. They pretended to examine the spokes and gears as they conversed, lips almost motionless, their voices barely audible over the night breeze and flap of cloaks.
"I overheard the master speaking to Exarta," Nairo told the others. "They intend to raise the boy in the teachings of the truth, and to return to Varadesh to use him against the archpriests of the Covenant."
"Dangerous," said Baphai,
wiping a hand across his beard to obscure his mouth as he spoke.
"If the Covenant hear anything of that, they'll hunt us down." "There's nothing we can do about it," said Maska,
moving to step away. Nairo caught the hem of her cloak and gently tugged her back.
"You mistake my meaning. Cor Pharaon is to fill Lorgar's head with the word and the truth, but perhaps that is not the only thing the boy will learn."
Laura darted him a look and then quickly concealed her concern by bending to the mechanism of the main telescope.
"Then it's not the Covenant who'll flay us, but the Master."
"Not if we're careful," said Baphai. "Just a lesson here, a lesson there. A bit of compassion, maybe."
"More than that," whispered Nairo.
He took a moment, judging his audience. If he confided his full beliefs, they might think him mad, but he could not let the opportunity pass.
"Lorgar could be our savior. All of us. All Colchisians. Cor Pharaon sort of believes it, though he thinks he will be the vessel of the power's return. He'll try to use Lorgar, whatever the boy turns out to be. What if Lorgar really is a fifth prophet? We cannot let Cor Pharaon control that sort of power."
"Control?"
Kaldeka scoffed. He buffed the barrel of the scope with the corner of his tunic.
"If Lorgar is a prophet, nobody will control him. None but the powers."
"I can't believe that," replied Nairo. "He is just a child at the moment, and a child can be taught no matter what destiny the powers have set in store for him. He could be the liberation of us all, the savior of the slaves."
"I'd settle for a less lofty goal," said Maska. "If he just makes our lives a little easier, I'd be..."
She trailed off, flicking a glance towards the temple rig before she moved away, attending to other tasks. Nairo glanced over his shoulder to see that Cor Faeron had emerged onto the deck, bathed in the reflected silvery glow of the stars. He gazed up at the Empyrean, and there was an unfamiliar smile upon his face. Nairo caught Baffai's look, a warning glance. He returned a reassuring wink and hurried back to the shrine wagon to attend to the master's wishes. 172. And so the rhythm of the caravan continued, changed in some ways, the status quo retained in others. Each wake day they traversed the dunes of the great wilderness, guided by the observations of the cold fall and high night before. Consulting the stars and the Book of Heavenly Scripts, Cor Faeron divined the will of the powers. Where before they had sought out other caravans, heading for the camps of the declined, oases and wadis, now the master of the temple eschewed his missionary goal, declaring that they must remain hidden from the prying eyes of those who would see the truth silenced. Cor Faeron led the slaves and converts in their prayers and dedications, before breakfast, on the cusp of wake-rise, and again before the meal that heralded the transition to Wakemane. They gathered, wearing prayer shawls to protect from sun or cold, during the last hour before rest-eve, and for brief invocations at the time of sleeping. He spent much time with Lorgar, reading from the texts and instilling his own thoughts into the boy. Lorgar had learned well the lesson of his beating, and paid more attention to the substance of the tracts as well as their detail. He tried hard to keep his questions to himself, but his curiosity was boundless, and occasionally his inquisitive nature got the better of his discipline. Sometimes Cor Faeron indulged these queries if the subject pleased him. Other times he called for Axarta to apply a short flogging for wasting the master's precious time. As attested to by the declined, Lorgar's growth was considerable, so that it seemed each morn day the fresh sunlight fell upon a youth who was noticeably taller and broader. For one so young, he possessed a bulk that would rival Axarta one day. His young skin bulged with latent muscle. His thirst for knowledge was insatiable, and he absorbed all that was passed to him as the sands of the white plains soak up every drop of rain that falls upon their barren expanse. Lorgar learned quickly, with a fierce appetite, not just to understand the texts of the ancients, but to hear more of the age before, of Colchis, of the prophets, of the caravans and trade routes. Most of all, though, he longed for stories of the great cities. It was in this capacity that Nairo and his companions were able to furnish a more rounded education than that provided by Cor Faeron. Whilst they prepared food, split and spliced cables, cleaned and polished, sawed and hammered, the slaves talked to Lorgar, telling him their tales, sometimes singing the songs of their peoples or sharing the folklore of the desert tribes. While everybody spoke the water words as the prescribed cant of the caravan, they each had their own dialects and doggerel. These Lorgar quickly assimilated, and was keen to demonstrate to Cor Faeron, but Nairo warned him not to reveal this to the master. Though dismayed by the thought of subterfuge, Lorgar seemed wary enough of his beatings that he held his tongue, and shared his linguistic skills only with the slaves. At times Nairo spied the youngster listening intently at the hatches or at the base of a mast beneath a guard nest, no doubt paying close attention to the languages of the guards too. Sure enough, after brief study, he displayed a remarkable breadth of curses and swear words from 36 different regions and cities. While this caused a certain amount of hilarity among the converts, who had also secretly started to share their own tales with the boy, it brought swift vocal and physical retribution from the master. 173. 40 wake rises and rest eves passed, by which time Lorgar was almost as tall as Nairo's shoulder, and easily more broad and heavy set. The acolyte frequently engaged in semantic debates with Cor Faeron, who tested his abilities by hurling doubts and questions that would be used by unbelievers, assuring himself that the child knew the responses to accusations of blasphemy and heresy, to specific arguments against the faith. The boy joked with the converts and slaves, and constructed elaborate fables from their histories, spinning truth into fanciful adventures through the divine realms of the Empyrean. For Nairo, it was a time as backbreaking as ever, but the presence of Lorgar alleviated some of the spiritual pain that he endured. When he saw the boy at prayer, he was reminded that hope had returned. Every dawnaway brought with it the promise of a new future. Though they did their best to avoid the traders and nomads, eventually their supplies ran low enough to force them back to the more populated tracts of the desert. On the sixth coldfall after Lorgar's discovery, Cor Pharaon consulted the heavenly messengers and asked them to provide guidance. Interpreting the movements above, the master declared that they would head to Ad-Drazonti, a nearby oasis. They set course, according to the observations, and expected to reach the oasis by wakemain of the coming morn day. The crew brought up empty water barrels, ready for filling, before the freeze of high night made extended labour impossible. Beneath the flickering lumen glare, Nairo and others struggled at a pulley and line above the main hatch. He felt a strong hand on his shoulder moving him aside. Lorgar stepped up to the opening and hauled out the keg one-handed, unhooking it from the cable with the other. With ease, he stacked it upon the few that had already been raised and returned to the hatch to send the cable down again. He jumped down into the darkness, where Maska and the others fumbled to drag the heavy barrels in the gloom, to hook them up to the winch. Lorgar seemed as keen-sighted as the rats that dwelt in the storage decks, and heaved the barrels to the opening two at a time, before he pulled himself up to the main deck and instructed those below to hang them on the line. With metronomic repetition, the boy laboured, tirelessly and with barely a sweat sheen on his golden skin. Not more than an hour had passed, and all of the barrels were stacked along the gunwales.
"What next?"
he asked Nairo, clearly invigorated not only by the physical exercise, but the practical nature of the task.
"It is rewarding, is it not, to sometimes labour at something measurable? It frees the mind to ponder the greater things. For instance, it has occurred to me, whilst I stacked these last dozen barrels, that we might consider it a metaphor for our spiritual labours. We can each work as hard as we are able, but only together can we achieve our ends. And as the barrels must be ordered, so too must our thoughts and prayers. The truth is that we each have a purpose, but it goes beyond that. Not just us, but all things are part of the order of the powers, to be set aright according to their plan."
The slave was unsure what to make of it, worried that Lorgar had absorbed too much of the master's demands for hierarchy and subjugation to the will of the impassioned, as he referred to those who had heeded the word and allowed the truth to enter their souls.
"Salting kegs," Nairo replied, after a moment's thought, pointing to the aft hatch. "We'll be bringing aboard meat."
Lorgar set to this task with equal vigour, singing hymns that Nairo recognised from verbal offerings in the temple, though with extra verses of his own invention. As he rolled the large salting kegs across the deck, he regaled his growing audience with "Glory to the Ascended," but each verse and chorus rendered into a different tongue, effortlessly translated on the fly by the youth, as several of the slaves and guards called out for him to use their native dialects next. 174. It was thus caught up in the festive air that Nairo and the others did not see or hear Cor Pharaon rise from his cabin. The first they realised of his coming was a thunderous bellow as he came into view up the steps from the below deck.
"What is this clownish mockery?"
Converts and slaves scattered like vermin before the lantern, suddenly occupied with tasks in the holds or engine rooms, or at the far ends of the temple rig. Lorgar stopped in his tracks, the barrel he had been kicking across the decking rolling to a halt against the gunwale. Nairo stayed close, unable to abandon the boy to face the master's displeasure alone. To his credit, Axarta remained also, suddenly hanging his head in shame, where moments before he had been cheerfully banging out the beat of the hymn with a fist on the rail.
"You!"
Cor Pharaon jabbed a finger towards the guard captain, who flinched as though the accusing digit was the barrel of a fusil.
"Ready your whip!"
The master rounded on the other converts, hectoring and snarling at them to drag forth the slaves who had shirked their duties. They complied quickly, fearing his wrath and that the scorn of the powers would fall upon them instead. It seemed that it took only moments to round up the 38 men and women, forced to their knees on the deck with Nairo.
"The powers set us in motion upon the face of the world,"
Corferon spat.
"Unto each of us they have poured their purpose, and into their great design they have woven us. If they had desired you to be idle, to giggle and cavort like cliff monkeys, they would not have seen fit to cast you into slavery. 6 lashes each."
175. Corferon turned from the slaves, having pronounced his judgment, focusing his scorn upon Lorgar. Though almost as big as the master, he quailed from Corferon's approach as if the powers themselves had sent an avatar of admonition against him.
"I sought only to help my master,"
the boy explained weakly, all strength and music robbed from his voice.
"It is not your place to help," Corferon replied quietly.
The first crack of the whip and yelp heralded the beginning of the punishment for the slaves. But Nairo and those not yet taken in the rough hands of the guards had eyes only for their master and Lorgar. Corferon spoke calmly, with none of his customary snarling and raging. He seemed disappointed by the boy, genuinely hurt that his acolyte had been so foolish.
"Would you do all of their labours, Lorgar?"
Corferon asked.
"Would you strip the meat from the bones? Stoke the fires, oil the gears, wash the clothes, varnish and paint the temple, sew the penance, sift the sand for land crabs and beetles and scorpions to cook?"
Lorgar stood dumbfounded, hands gripping each other in front of him, confusion written across his features.
"What of the other slaves, Lorgar?"
Corferon waved a hand past the rail to the darkness of the night. "Not just those of this caravan, but the others of 100 traders, 1,000 merchants, and the millions in the cities.
Would you take all of their labours away? Who would nurse the children? Who would set stone upon stone to erect the monuments to the powers? Who would stoke the furnaces and polish the lecterns and inscribe new copies of the texts? Would you do all of that for them?"
The boy shook his head, shoulders slumped, not looking at his master. The wails of the beaten slaves grew in volume as their punishment continued, the guards working their way towards Nairo. Still, he could not turn his gaze from the pair.
"No. No, my master,"
Lorgar mumbled.
"No."
Corferon approached his acolyte, stood a little more than arm's length away.
"So you would decide those you would relinquish of their duties and those who must labour still? You, a mortal, would be the arbiter of who is to slave for others?"
"I..."
Lorgar had no reply to this argument. His lip trembled and he glanced at Nairo. His eyes were filled with apology and resignation as Nairo felt unruly fingers clamp onto his shoulder. He looked up to see Karad, one of the archer brethren. There was no such pity in her eyes as she pulled the slave to his feet and dragged him towards Axata's waiting lash. Nairo glanced back, imploring Lorgar with a glance, but the boy's expression hardened and he looked back to Corferon.
"My deepest apologies, my master,"
Lorgar said, bowing his head, even as Nairo was bent over the rail and the first touch of the whip scored hot pain across the slave's shoulders. 176. As the punishment continued, Corferon looked at the line of slaves, their backs bruised and bloodied, and returned his attention to Lorgar. The preacher was pleased that he had kept his temper. It helped to remember that, despite his size and intellect, Lorgar was still a child, and whatever abilities the powers had instilled into him, he remained ignorant and innocent in many ways. His actions were not rebellion against Corferon, simply misguided. Even so, the fault lay in the compassion as much as the act itself. To feel pity for the slaves was to begin to judge the powers. If one thought that another did not deserve the lot to which they had been dealt, it was open invitation to other doubts, doubts that could lead to open defiance of the powers and the truth. Corferon knew he would have to be careful, lest Lorgar started seeing the slaves as victims, rather than deserving of their suffering.
Logar, attend to me,
he barked, crooking a finger towards the youth. Logar approached along the deck, his expression bereft of suspicion or guile.
Yes, my master.
The slaves have been punished for shirking their duties, but the trespass was not theirs alone.
No, my master.
Logar hung his head, shame-faced, his bald pate catching the yellow glare of the temple rig's hanging lanterns.
It was because of me that they transgressed.
You have natural wit and charisma, Logar, and others attend to your every word. That is a big responsibility.
Yes, my master.
Corferon paused a moment to ensure he phrased his next words properly as he looked down at the child. He did not want to even suggest the possibility that Logar might use his emerging abilities for any cause other than that of his master. But it was a delicate subject to broach, for in denying the moral right to do so, Corferon would introduce the concept itself. At the moment it seemed that the notion of rebellion was not even within Lorgar's mental compass.
You must swear to me now, an oath upon the powers.
An oath, my master?
A promise, witnessed by the powers, bound to your soul. You will swear by the powers that you will be a defender of the truth. You shall take the word and the truth to guide you in all things. Upon your immortal soul, give your word to the powers that all you do shall work to their glory and cause.
I do, my master.
Say the words and look to the Empyrean as you declare them. Give your oath fully, so that all might hear it, both mortal and those beyond.
Logar glanced at Corferon, and then turned his eyes upwards, his gaze moving to the distant stars.
I swear. I promise.
Logar faltered, uncharacteristically lost for words. He looked to Corferon with a pleading expression. The moment pleased the preacher greatly, for it served as a reminder that he was the teacher, that Logar still had much to learn, and only from Corferon would he receive such tutelage.
Something like, I swear by the almighty powers, would be a good start, and then say what you promise to do.
Logar smiled and nodded, turning his gaze heavenwards once again.
I swear by the almighty powers that I shall dedicate my life to learning the word and the truth, and to serve the powers as they see fit to guide me. I shall heed their messages from the Empyrean, as they lay them in signs upon the sands and stars, in the minds and hearts of people. All of this I promise, and if I should fail, my immortal soul shall be cast from the Empyrean to dwell in the torment of the passionless void.
177.
Good,
said Corferon, feeling a stab of pride at the boy's forthright pronouncement. He saw that the guards and slaves had heard the clear declaration, not only reminding them of the truth to which they were all subject, but also of Corferon's authority over Logar, and, by extension of that, every member of the caravan.
Now, child, there is the matter of your punishment.
Again Logar nodded his acquiescence, saying nothing. He strode to the rail, stepping past the cowering and moaning slaves. He placed his broad hands upon the metal and bent over, looking to Axarta. The convert's captain glanced over to his master for confirmation, and Corferon held up 8 fingers in answer.
2 more lashes than the slaves, Axarta, for being the instigator of this sinful exhibition.
Axarta signalled his understanding and readied his whip. Corferon noticed him exchanging looks with several of his companions, and though it was impossible to know exactly what thought they shared, it seemed to the preacher that they understood how they had been complicit in the debacle. That they had been spared would not pass without remark amongst their ranks, and Corferon would take time to remind Axarta that he also had onerous responsibilities. Impassively, Corferon watched as the whip fell across the back of Logar, just beneath the shoulder blades. The acolyte's robe absorbed some of the sharp crack, and the boy barely moved. The priest could see nothing of Lorgar's face, but his shoulders were hunched, fingertips digging into the wood of the rail.
7 more,
he reminded Axarta, and turned away to the steps.
This is a congregation of worship, not a circus.